also go to your mailbag, because you may have gotten a couple of pieces of mail. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2BYZ.
Okay, we'll get you one second. K2BYZ, I believe it is. All right, very good. Well, okay, the gap antenna, if you get a chance, take a look at that QST article. I gave you the year and the month of how they explain or try to explain how it works, and see what you think of that article. And as far as bringing, well, now here at my house, they're here, of course, I'm drilled right through the wall. I have a number of ports that I just drilled right through and roll in back of the equipment. And, just packed it with that the air conditioner putty where the cable bends the wall, but I do have to feed through that I mentioned a number of times that I made for the open wire feeders using those insulators. That the insulated rod that is used in the ignition system and oil burners. That's my feed through my open wire feeder. As far as when I did other locations, we lived several other places, what I used to use is the air conditioner foam. You know, these insulation that they sell you for the air conditioning, you put it in an air conditioner window, and you get this material that you stuff on top of the windows with it, the two windows come together, you get this like foamite insulation, and I took those two pieces of that and put one down on the sill and another piece on top of the cable and just closed the window on it, and that's it. You can just cut it with scissors. You're in business. So that's a quick way, and very tight insulation that way, and easily removed, you know, when you leave, no telltale sign. Okay, let's see, there was one station just asked the question, so let's pick them up, and then, okay, we'll pick another one out of the mailbag, over.
Okay, KC2BYZ, I think it was, you got it, Dan. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. Let's see, I got my general a couple weeks ago, so I hooked up an HF rig. I thinking about antennas, I figured a wire was the easiest way to go, so I bought a full-length G5RV, 102 feet. So, I ordered this not actually measuring the property from front to back, and here in Queens I have about 90 feet from the front of the roof to the end of the backyard. So, running a full-length isn't really an option. I have it about 25 feet up. I was going to go from the front of the roof to the top of the wash pole, about 30 feet up, but that was sloping too much and it was going to lay on the roof. So instead, I've got it going from the level of the roof itself in the front to the back on a pole about 10 feet up, and then back to the front as sort of an inverted V laying on its side, which is working decently. In the past week, I've been able to work France, I've been able to work Morocco. On 20 meters, the 40 is a different story. I'm having zero luck whatsoever. I had one contact on 40 today. I was able to work Canada at Nova Scotia, about 800 miles. So the question basically is, what are effective ways to run that antenna? If I slope it, I can probably run it to the back and let it slope a bit, and it would be in sort of a U-shape. Or if not, would I run it straight across and let it lay over either side? Insulated from any metal surfaces, and yes, that would work. And furthermore, if 30 feet is high enough to give me a decent, a low enough takeoff angle to work DX on 40 meters and below, if that's possible at all, because from what I'm told is that anything, you know, it would need to be higher at that level. 20 seems to be working good as far as skip, but it seems to be stuck on ground wave with 40. What do you think?
Okay, I've got a couple of comments on this one, Dan. After I finish, I'm going to pass it over to Mel, because I think some of his guys in Brooklyn have had somewhat similar circumstances to yours. As you go to the lower bands, in other words, 20 meters, 14 megacycles, you have certain performance at 30 foot of altitude. But 30 foot of altitude at 40 meters, and particularly on 80 meters, you're starting to become a near vertical incident skywave antenna. In other words, the signal tends to go more straight up as opposed to the horizon. I'm going to sort of explain why it's doing that, Dan. Angle of takeoff of antennas, something that confuses people quite a bit. You're putting an antenna 30 feet above the ground, and your eye sees that ground as dirt and grass and pavement. To a signal at 40 meters, that ground that is 30 feet above is almost a perfect mirror, a slightly absorptive mirror, but almost a perfect mirror. And when a horizontally polarized signal from your G5RV strikes the ground, the reflection you get off the ground is opposite in phase, 180 degrees out of phase. The bottom line of all this is that if you look at the whole situation side view, you really got a real G5RV dipole-like antenna 30 feet above the ground. You have a mirror image of one 30 feet below the ground. Unfortunately, the mirror image of the one 30 feet below the ground is out of phase, 180 degrees out of phase, with the one above ground. And if you really include the dielectric characteristics of Earth, it's not completely conductive, it's slightly resistive with water in it, whatever. It's not exactly 180 degrees, but it's close to 180 degrees of phase reversal. As such, if you now figure out what happens to a signal going out to the horizon, it's getting a real signal from the antenna above the ground, it's getting a signal from a bounce somewhere in front of your antenna, which looks like it's coming from the mirror image of the antenna 30 feet below the ground. They're out of phase. As such, it cancels on the horizon, tends to cancel. Not a complete cancellation, because the mirror image is a little bit weaker. As you go to higher elevation angles, we're looking at a side view of the situation now, and you're looking at your dipole end view. You're looking at the you're looking down the wire of the dipole, so to speak. You've got one above the ground and one below the ground. And if I now walk to the right, so to speak, start figuring out what happens at various elevation angles, at some number of degrees above the horizon, I'm going to pick a number, 30 degrees above the horizon, you draw a line with a 30-degree slope going off to the right, and you'll soon see that the signal coming from the ground-reflected image antenna is a longer path than the one from the real antenna above the ground. And when you've got that angle of elevation just right, there's another 180 degrees of phase length because of the extra time delay to the mirror image antenna. That explains why you've got a certain elevation takeoff angle. So the bottom line of all this is that elevation takeoff angle is a function of altitude. The higher the altitude, the lower the angle, the better the DX. So you're not going to have a gangbuster antenna at 30 feet. 50, 60 feet would work a lot better. It doesn't mean you're off the air because you don't hit the 60 or 60 feet. Just know that if you have a tree on the property, if you put up a tower or an artificial tree or whatever, and we're able to, by some means, get some extra altitude, you'll get some extra performance. The way you zigzag the antenna itself, the tips going down to the ground, left and right, north, south, east, west, almost doesn't matter. You could say that the majority of the radiation takes place from the center of the antenna. I'm giving you some simplification. But the center of the antenna, how high it is above the ground, really determines the majority of what they call the phase center of the antenna, and therefore your takeoff angle. So how you twist the antenna around the property, over the roof, under the garage, whatever, doesn't matter as much. That's not going to make as big a deal. The only two things that are going to count is there the majority of your antenna at right angles to your desired direction? If, for instance, you want to talk to a guy in London, the Great Circle Path between you and London is about 30 degrees north of east. It's about a 45-degree azimuth angle, 45 degrees to the right of north is where the greatest, shortest distance between you and London is. That's the direction that the Lindbergh took off when he wanted to go to France, so to speak. So if the antenna is broadside to that, in other words, if the antenna goes to the southeast and the northwest, you're going to get the greatest azimuth angle of takeoff toward London. And then altitude is going to determine your elevation angle of takeoff. So these are the things that are the biggest variables. As long as your G5RV is giving you some kind of a reasonable standing wave ratio on 40 meters, it's radiating that signal pretty well. And even if the standing wave ratio is high, if you've got a good antenna tuner and a low enough feed line loss, the transmitter will be happy, the receiver will be happy, you'll be radiating 90% of your power into space somewhere. But I think your greatest difficulty right now is a substantial amount of the energy is going straight up because of fairly low altitude. It's not stopping you, just don't expect to be the strongest guy on the band with that particular antenna today. And you and I are going to be dreaming about a better antenna, Dan, that we're going to have sometime in the future with higher altitude and more gain, maybe a Yagi someday. Let's see how Mel would solve this particular problem if he was living in your particular QTH in Queens. Those Brooklyn guys, they got a different slant on things. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I've experienced all this and much more. Did quite a bit of experiments with antennas of different heights, especially dipoles, being that I stick to always the simplest antennas put together, and also cheapest antennas, I guess you could go. On 40 meters, I did an experiment. In fact, still using one of the dipoles right now. I'm 40 meters. I'm a CW, mostly a CW operator on the low frequency, except for 75 meters where I get on with my friends on schedule, where I'm using on 80 meters, 75 meters, my transmitting loop, which is 272 feet of wire. That's 45 feet up. The transmitting loop that I'm using on 75, I'm not looking at for a DX antenna. I'm looking for something that gives me good coverage for my friends that are located within a few hundred miles of my location, so it works quite well for that. However, on 40 meters, I have wanted to, at times on CW, do some low-band DXing on 40 and 80. On 80 CW, I'm using a vertical at 65 feet high, and with approximately, maybe about 5,000 to 6,000, at least 6,000 feet of radials that are buried. The 40-meter dipole that I experimented with, I originally put it up, and I found, well, when it was up to good height, about 65 feet up, it worked extremely well. I started lowering it down, trying it at different heights, listening to basically the same station. I know certain DX stations on 40 meters are always on. I know the guys quite well, worked many times. Number of them are very nice about making on-the-air tests with you, AV antenna tests and things of that such. So I did conduct that, and I found that if I took that 40-meter dipole, just as Dick said, and I lowered it down, it didn't seem to do much as far as an effective radiator below about 45 feet. It just seems like it was fading out, you may say. So what I began doing is tilting it, and I may turned it actually eventually into a sloper, quite a steep sloper. The bottom is, with the horizontal on the bottom, it's about 60 degrees, so it's a good slope antenna. And I found that going from a level of about 65 feet up and extending the dipole down to the ground, on 40 meters, seems to work excellent DX antenna. That's one way, in other words, turn it into a sloper. Other than that, I don't think you're going to take a G5RV and really make it effective on 40 meters below 45 feet. That's my personal view on that. Dick, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. There's the voice of experience, Dan. Man who's been there and done it. So it's not going to stop you. It's just that you're not going to be able to get all of those answers from those DX stations. You're not going to be the big gun, but you're still going to get a lot of enjoyment. KC2 BYV K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out a way to work the lower band 120 closes. Like I said, it's working very well on 20. I mean, it's only been using it for a week, but I think not doing too bad, but yeah, I'm trying to get a little lower. If I use a vertical, Does the height above ground matter that much?
Everybody thinks it doesn't, but it does. Boy, does it. There's a lot of hidden traps on that one, Dan. And we're glad you asked. The good news about a vertical is that vertically polarized energy, when it reflects off the ground, doesn't have the same kind of phase reversal that horizontal does. So the good news is you do get low angle of radiation off of a vertical, reasonably low to the ground, or even right on the ground. That's the good news. The bad news is that unless you lay down a zillion ground plane radials, the so-called counterpoise to the antenna, you have a hidden loss that doesn't show. Your standing wave ratio will be beautiful. You pour 150 watts into the antenna, and only 1 watt reflects back to you, and you think it's all being radiated into space. It's not. It takes probably, I'm going to pick a number, 30 radials on the ground to make your ground look like a mirror, a conductor, and so the signal is radiated into space. Anything less than 30 radials, and you can get away with four, but with four radials, there's some substantial gaps between those radials where the RF energy sees the Earth and the vertically polarized energy gets absorbed by the Earth and gets turned into heat. In the wintertime, the worms in your backyard will be happy. You'll be keeping them warm. But when you take that RF energy and turn it into heat, it's wasted, and you don't get a chance to radiate into space. So you've got two choices with a vertical antenna. Elevate the thing above the Earth by putting the vertical ground plane antenna with its ground plane radials up on the roof of the house. It's not an attractive-looking structure to some people, but the fact that the ground plane radials are up above Earth means that you're further away from that ground that's going to be absorbing the energy, and your efficiency goes up, and your signal strength goes up, and because it's vertically polarized, you'll have a reasonably low angle of radiation. There's another way to skin the cat, though, as they say, and that is all those ground plane radials are the second half of the dipole. You're trying to make it look like a sheet of metal, where you've got the first half of the dipole above and the mirror image the other one below. Well, why construct a phony mirror image? If you've got enough altitude of a tree or something light on the property, in the case of 40 meters, it would have to be a 65-foot high tree. But if you've got a tree that's 65-foot high, you could put a true vertically polarized full half-wave dipole up against that tree. It'll scare you. You think the tree's going to be absorbing energy. Uh-oh. That tree is 90-some-odd% transparent to 40-meter energy, even if it's laying right alongside of the trunk, only 1.5 feet away from it, so to speak. So, and the vertically polarized dipole doesn't have to be exactly 65 feet long. If your tree is only 48 feet long, there's ways you can electrically make the dipole half wave, but mechanically shorten it. Loading coils near the center, top hat capacitors near the end, zigzagging. There's ways that you can make a true vertically polarized dipole, and you don't have to waste time with all those ground plane radials, and now you're not launching energy into the Earth, and your center of radiation is higher up. That's an antenna that I just mentioned that very few people have ever considered. They think the tree is going to be a dead short circuit against the dipole. It is not. So you got more possibilities than you may know about, Dan. Back to you for any fills or comments on this one. KC2BYZ, K2LIW, in the TechNet.
Yeah, tomorrow I'll try to figure out a way to get a little higher or change its angle. Like I said, right now it's in a bit of a V. I'd like to, I just had an experiment to see if I can get a little better propagation if I turn that V into a straight line and go from front to back. But if I do that, it's either going to be sloping down in a bit of a U or hanging over something, and I just have to figure out a way to insulate it from whatever hangs over. So, yeah, we'll play with it. I thank you for the insight and see what we can do with it, KC2BYZ.
And consider something else, Dan. The wire-like dipole, that's G5RV, wire-like antenna, the raw materials that go into it are not expensive. Don't stop at one. If you're crafty enough, you'll find a way to lay one east and west on your property. You'll find a way to lay one north and south. Yeah, the north and south one will have some zigzags to the east and west. And the east-west one will have some zigzags to the north and south. It doesn't matter. Put up more than one. Maybe at different altitudes, different angles. And then you can flip back and forth between the two with a selector switch in the shack, or just un, unconnect one cable and connect the other to the rig, but you'll be amazed how often sometimes the signal from London is real strong on one antenna, and the next day the signal from London is real strong on the other antenna. And London is in the exact same spot. You're going to say, what's going on? Well, we all forget about the fact that Faraday rotation is existing. In other words, we call it a bounce. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but the signal bounces off the ionosphere, and the short circle, the short great circle path between us and London is a known angle. However, when that signal goes through the ionosphere, where it's mixing with magnetic fields, it is being twisted in polarization, sometimes multiple times. The guy in London may send a horizontal signal to you, and by the time it gets to Manhattan Street in Ridgewood, New York, it may be a vertically polarized signal, and vice versa. And by the way, when I say vice versa, you got to be careful. Faraday rotation does not obey reciprocity. The possibility exists, the signal from London, he launches horizontal, you get vertical. And you launch a signal from Ridgewood, and you're launching horizontal, and he gets horizontal. You would think you launch horizontal, he gets vertical. Just because he launched horizontal, you got vertical. It doesn't work the same in the two different directions. It's a crazy way the magnetic field mixes with Faraday rotation. So when you put up multiple antennas, it's not only which angle of radiation, it's not only which angle in azimuth, but it's the function of which polarization. What Mel has discovered with his tiny little loop antenna, a tenth of a wavelength or something like that, in diameter, and he's using it on 80 meters, and the antenna is located in the shack with him, and it's down essentially at ground level. Because he can tilt it in polarization and rotate it and tilt it in azimuth and elevation, he can tune for the best signal he gets from, let's say, London or his buddy in Pennsylvania today. And tomorrow he tunes it slightly differently. The full 260-foot circumference loop antenna on 80 meters, that's 40 feet in the air on four towers 40 foot high in his backyard. Quite often, that great big antenna gets less signal than his loop antenna in the shack because he can tune it and favor the angles and the polarizations. When he tells his buddies on 80 meters what he's doing and how much better performance he gets out of the tiny loop antenna, they say, what in the world are you smoking, Mel? They don't believe him. He's had a lot of flack over that. Good thing he's a tough guy. He can take it, and he knows he's right. So even consider that as a possibility. I'm going to turn it over to Mel, and I'll bet you you've had a number of people who really think you're making up a tall story, and they think it's April 1st, and you don't know the date, and so on. I bet you've run into that a few times, Mel. KQKEY, KQRIW.
W2L repeater system.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Oh, yes, I've had to go into a lot of detail many a time, refer them also to articles in the magazine about the small loops and what they're capable of. And so, I can say I've done that many a time. And final words, let me just say about why many times that I get on with my friends and I have to tell them just do some basic chattering, just some talk so I can get the loop set up and find out which way I'm going to receive you properly tonight. Because like Dick just said, the Faraday rotation from night to night, it varies widely. But the real prime reason that I have that loop, well, I have actually two of them, one inside the other, it goes into a bit of a complicated system that uses for QRN squashing. That's basically the problem. There's a lot of noise here where I'm located with who knows what kinds of crazy static you get that is localized at times. I just can't really run down some of it because so many different versions of from different places. So what I do is I can null out the primary noise with the second loop, and so that the primary loop is picking up the signal, the secondary loop is acting as a noise detection system, going through the QRN squasher and then the preamp, and also presents to the receiver a much cleaner, lower noise signal. So my signal to noise ratio is improved quite a bit, that many times, is the big advantage of the receiving loop versus the outside transmitting loop, which is 272 feet of wire for support up at 45 feet. Now, as far as the dipole on 40 meters, I've done another experiment, Dick, and again, like I said, I have a sort of a great audience out there, and one guy in Germany, especially DL4UR, is a wonderful guy who especially is doing an antenna experiment. Gets the lights up because he loves antennas. He says he's trying all kinds of configurations. To hear what I'm up to right now. Now, with the dipole, you need a dipole, like I say, I tried it at various heights. Then I went ahead and I took the one support point, which is 65 feet up, and I pulled the antenna at that, up to that one end of it, up to its full height. And now what I did is, again, this situation where I was beginning to bring the other end down to vertical. And after a number of checks, whether or not, because the angle I was bringing it down, you know, was just effective more to Europe or whatever, because I don't really have the facility to move, to, you know, move it at different spots at that angle, you know, to reduce that angle. But I found that when the dipole, the 40-meter dipole, comes down from 65 feet to the ground, making a 60-degree angle with the ground, that it seems to be the most effective for some reason, Dick. Better than it is when it's pure vertical. So now I've got more of a sloper. Now, is this basically, I'm thinking that because it's maybe a happy medium between, you know, Faraday rotation from horizontal to vertical, possibility, I think maybe that's the factor over.
I think you've got a variation in takeoff angle, because when you're running horizontal polarization, you're getting a real loop above ground and a phony one, a mirror image of one below ground. Thank you. And that's one of the variables. There's lots of things changing here all at once. During the time the signal is coming to you vertically polarized, the ground reflection doesn't behave the same way. We all forget about the fact that that Faraday rotation is taking place, forget about the fact that the Earth that we stand on or that our house is positioned on is essentially a mirror. It's a 90% efficiency mirror. So there's almost every one of our antennas, there's a real one above ground and a mirror image of one below ground. And some of us have an environment where there's a water tower in certain directions and other reflecting objects. That's a secondary phenomenon. When it comes to VHF operation and you've got short wavelengths, yes, I personally have reflected signals off of Empire State Building, World Trade Center. We think we've reflected signals off of the Verrazano Bridge when I was talking to my microwave buddies on 10 gigahertz over in New Jersey. We tried doing a reflection off of a building like that on 80 meters, and it doesn't work for a couple of reasons. One, the noise on the band is so much louder, and second of all, the wavelengths are so much bigger that the percentage of reflection you get off that object becomes smaller. The object has to look large compared to the wavelength in order to give you a substantial reflection. So that water tower and the tree and the other thing that's in your neighborhood on 80 meters is almost completely transparent. Yeah, I'll admit that if you live next door to the World Trade Center, a building that's 300 foot on the side, yes, and you've got a 130-foot long antenna, in that direction you're going to get a substantial blockage. But very few of us live in something quite that bad. It would be an awful lot of fun to find the right kind of a computer program where you can literally plug in the altitude of your antenna, the altitude of your land, the surrounding terrain, where the water tower, where the buildings are, particularly if you live in a metro area. It'd be nice if somebody has and you can find a computer program where you plug in all that raw data and then find out what the signals are going to be like toward London, toward South Africa, toward Australia, and so on. Mel, to your knowledge, has anyone ever come up with a program like that so you can model it to your environment and find out how things should work? And once you can do that, you can say, gee, if I use this kind of an antenna, what kind of performance am I going to get in that environment? And if I use this other kind of antenna, toward Australia, is it going to be a whole lot better because of the local reflection? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have a comment. WHCDO, when you get a chance.
Okay, Andy, we're going to pick up Andy right up the mail. You got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I have been involved somewhat with that. There was a program not specifically meant for amateur radio use, but it's a topography program. And you can get your, you know, your height above sea level, et cetera, and all. And basically what you do is you look at, with your antenna, what is 50 wavelengths ahead of it at that frequency. And it would give you a fairly good idea of what, you know, to expect. So that's about the best you can do. Of course, you can't, like you say, can't really move objects. It happens to be a big building that's 300 feet wide, made out of aluminum, out of casing. You're just stuck. But it is a fairly good modeling program to that extent. Of course, my situation, I got water, so I don't really have to really be too much concerned because for me, Europe is straight over the ocean. I'm right on the ocean, of course, here, 300 feet off the Atlantic Ocean, and I'm surrounded by water here on this so-called little peninsula here. So I don't really have, you know, any kind of problem to that extent. However, you can, like I say, you know, many times, like, just as I mentioned with dipole, is tweak it. In other words, yes, cutting it, getting it to resonate, everything. Whatnot, but many times, you know, you do something with it that you think to be out of left field. Like, you would say, gee, I'm tilting it and I'm getting it when it's vertical, it's not working as good as it is somewhat as a smoke. You know, you wouldn't expect to see that, especially on 40 meters, but it's evidence that things like that can take place. So, like you say, antennas are a lot of fun, you do a lot of experimenting, and doesn't cost you any really too much money. So, you just try a number of combinations, and you know, you'd be amazed sometimes what you can come up with. Go ahead, Ben.
Sounds like fun. Antennas are not experimental. I mean, none of us builds our HF rig anymore at 80 to 10 meter single sideband transceiver with a microprocessor inside. In my early days of ham radio, in Mel's early days, we used to build our rigs, and now you don't do that. But the antenna, you do. And you can tailor it to your particular property. I bet you Andy's already done that. The W2CDL, K2RIW.
Exactly. I've done a few. Also, my very, very first transmitter was a homebrew 15-watt, 40-meter CW transmitter using a 6CW4. I'm sorry, 6AQ5 is what I meant. 6AQ5B power audio output tube, running about 15 watts output, using an FT243 crystal on 40 meters, 7180 or around there. And my first contact was with a dipole antenna, and I worked Manchester, England. And I even have the QSL card to prove it. So, there you go. Put up my own dipole. Even built my own little transmitter. You were talking about the GAP antennas. I just wanted to tell you some experience that I've had with GAP antennas. And I own one, but I've yet to build it and put it up. It's laying in my backyard, and I do want to get it on my garage. The one that I bought is the Titan. And the Titan is the more expensive one, or the most expensive one. It covers all the bands. It covers 80 to 10 meters. And what they claim, because of the elevated feed point that it has, and you're talking about making the ground nice and warm, the elevated feed point, according to them, will reduce the earth loss and eventually, or essentially, eliminates the need for a radio system. So one of their big features that requires no radials. Also, because it has the built-in counterpoise, and the counterpoise is really very simple. It's 80, it's actually 480 inch lengths of, I think it's 16 gauge, it's stranded wire, I think it's 16 gauge, 14 gauge, something like that. Mel will probably know, I think he was talking about the Titan, or one of the gap antennas. And the counterpoise mounts right below the main radiating elements. The antenna is, it's pretty well constructed, but there is one problem that I discovered, because I helped a friend, he has a gap antenna, the same one, the Titan, and it was not working properly. In fact, I put the MSK antenna analyzer on it, and the SWR is sky high, more than 10 to 1 across the band. I found the counterpoise was incorrectly wired. There are insulators, part of the counterpoise supporting elements have to be insulated, and it was backwards, so the counterpoise wasn't doing anything. You have to have the counterpoise. Without that, the whole antenna, all the bands will not radiate, because you will not have a match to the antenna. So we fixed that, and then we measured the SWR across the entire band, and it was flat, meaning that there were hardly any bumps from for the 2-to-1 bandwidth that they recommend it should be. They say the bandwidth is under 2-to-1 across the band, and it was, and that worked out fine. The only problem with this antenna is adjusting the 80 meter portion, because that's at the very top, and there's a capacitor that you either add or remove depending on what portion of the 80 meter band you're going to be on. And to get up to that height, because this antenna, it's not a small antenna, it's about 25 feet tall, and it weighs more than 25 pounds, so it's pretty rugged. The good news, like you say, Dick, is it can be mounted, according to what they say, 1 foot, 1 foot above the ground. You could take a piece of masting and just bang it into the ground and just have it stick up from the ground 1 foot, mount the antenna, and have the counterpoise that low to the ground. In this particular installation, this antenna was mounted about 10 feet above the ground. At least that's where the counterpoise, the bottom of the antenna, started. Reports that I hear is that the antenna works quite well. And I have yet to experiment with mine when I get mine up. And I'll let you know how that works out. And also, the antenna is kind of pricey. Gap sells them for $300 and change. And it's a little bit on the high side, considering it's just a vertical antenna, but it is unique in its own way, and you can go to their website and read more about it. I just thought I'd just add that in as a footnote to what you were talking about earlier, Dick. Back to you, WHSTDO.
Yeah, thank you for that, Andy. We did go to the website. I did. A few minutes ago, saw those pictures. Those four rods that hang down and those four rods that go up from the center, so to speak, to your knowledge, are they somewhat like a trap dipole? Is that the right word? Multi-dipole, you know what I mean? The kind of dipole where you've got an 80 meter, a 15 meter, a 40 meter, and so on, all in parallel with each other, a fan dipole. Is there a little bit of a fan dipole-like arrangement there with all those rods hanging down? Because they seem to be slightly different lengths, although the lengths are nowhere different enough to cover all those bands. Have you figured out roughly how those rods are connected and what they're really doing, Andy? W2CDL, K2LAW?
Yeah, that's the best question, because I have mine, it's disassembled, I bought it used, and I have yet to figure this out, because in looking at it, the one that I did adjust was already assembled, and it's hard to see what's going on when it's fully installed, and in the vertical position. But I can tell you that since mine is disassembled, the coax that they give you, which happens to be yellow in color, I don't know why, is running in the center of the mast that support it. And it's not the elements, but it's just the mast itself. And then you have, like you say, these elements that run parallel to each other. Now, in tracing it out briefly, the coax runs up and comes back down and loops back up and comes back down and loops back up and all that, just like you're talking about. But I have yet to really study it to see how this thing is constructed, because it's a little bit complicated to figure out the way they do it. And the instructions, that was the worst part of this antenna, because in trying to get this thing tuned properly, I was reading the instructions that come with it, and it's really not clear. The wording is really not precise, and if you download the, I see the website now, you can download the manual, and I have the book on it, and I had to read the book like 3 times to say, oh, that's what they're talking about. So it's not really that clear, and maybe somebody else can make a comment about that. But once I study it, I'll let you know what I find with this thing. Performance-wise, it's supposed to be excellent from people that I know that have the GAP. Assembly and understanding the instructions, that's a little bit more difficult. Back to you.
I've got to guess that this thing is really electronically a vertically polarized dipole on each of those bands. What do you think, Andy?
That's what it seems to me, considering the size of the elements itself to cover all the bands that it has to cover. I mean, you know, it's only 25 feet tall, and that's pretty small, and there are no traps in this thing. So to make it resonant across the bands, you have to have some means of doing that. So that would make sense the way you're explaining it.
It's also possible that when you feed a vertical dipole from one end by feeding the coax cable up through the tubing that constitutes the lower half of the dipole, you've got a substantial amount of capacitive coupling between that lower piece of tubing, the lower half of the dipole, and the transmission line, the coax cable. By looping it back and forth, making that act as a choke, I think you eliminate an awful lot of that coupling effect. That's what I think is going on. Altogether, it sounds like a rather crafty antenna. I see a lot of capability of that thing. Too bad it's a little bit. Too bad it's so pricey. Looking at the photograph, my impression is $50 worth of hardware there, if you wanted to homebrew it. Didn't say it's easy, didn't say you should do that. But for people of our affluence, Andy, sometimes you and I just want to write a check and make the problem go away, so I see the possibility of that being a pretty nice antenna. I'm going to turn it back to Mel. He doesn't own one yet, but he's already been involved in one being put together. I bet you had a good time reading the instruction manual on that, Mel. And maybe you might want to dig into the mailbag if you don't want to discuss some other subject. The choice is yours. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Okay, just a few final words on the GAP, and we can pick this up and continue, just like you say, because there's a lot more to it that meets the eye. In fact, the person that bought it experienced the same situation when I came over there. He had all the parts laid out. He said, I checked everything. And he says, I started reading this. He says, Mel, if you're not going to help me put this together, so I'm back in the box and back to the company. He says, this thing, he says, the book, you just see a lot of contradictions and things in there and all. It's not, you know what it is? You can't really word it properly because unless you visualize what the heck you're doing here, it's a little bit difficult to put this thing, you know, in perspective when you're looking at all these parts that they give you. Yeah, they got a bunch of pieces, all kinds of pieces. So it's pricey. You got maybe... I guess you could have $50 worth of hardware there. I thought at one time that I'd like to just homebrew one just for one band. And the coax cable, I should say, is just as Andy just said, It snakes up and down. They said it zigzags up the top section, not in the bottom section. It comes already, this yellow coax, as Andy said. It comes, and it's zigzagging up and down, and it's connected, the open point on the coax. The open point is up at the top, all the way up at the top, where you put a capacitor and then put the cover on, you know, the plastic cover on to keep the moisture out, the rains out of it. Now, the bottom section is not the where the gap is, where you would think maybe you feed it there. No. No feeding at that point. That's just a spacer. And then they have this so-called counterpoise, which is four 80-inch rods, aluminum rods that are connected to the main pipe, the lower main pipe. At the end of these rods, there's insulators, except for one. Now, what you do is you stretch the wire around through these insulator loops that sit on the end of these rods, these are plastic they give you. But the one rod where it goes to, that's where you make contact with this. In other words, you start at the rod that has no insulator. You screw the piece of number 14 wire to it. Then you go around through all those insulators and you come back. You don't quite go to that rod. They give you a piece of cord. And the piece of cord is got a plastic eye, and it ties to that rod. In other words, you're coming all the way around, ties one end of the cord ties to this rod. That's where the wire started, and the other end goes to the piece of wire, number 14 wire, that don't quite go all the way, and they tell you to adjust it some way. To touch it up, you adjust actually, you fold back this number 14 wire or you extend it out, but it never touches that rod. In other words, it doesn't complete the rectangle, Dick, over.
Very crafty. We've talked about zigzagging the antenna, and that is a kind of a zigzag. The bottom half of the monopole, dipole, call it what you like, is really this, you go out on one of those rods and then you go around that circumferential piece of wire that doesn't complete the loop. Very crafty. I like it. I think it's a highly modified vertical dipole with end loading effects and center choking effects and so on. And I guess it works in 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. Do you think it also is claiming to perform well on the walk band? You did tell me that it's somewhat narrow band. In other words, you tell the guy who's building it for you that you're a CW operator or you're a single sideband operator. And he tunes it appropriately for those bands. I guess he adjusts the length of rod to compensate. But I wonder, does it also cover the walk bands, or is it pretty happy just covering the five major ham radio bands? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I'm looking at the Titan right now. 10, 12, 15, 17, 20, 30, and 40 meters and 100 kilohertz on 80 meters. There it is. And so it covers the walk band. That's the one, the Titan DX. Now, as far as, like I say, there's a little bit more to it than meets the eye. That's why I think I gave you the QST article on when they viewed the antenna, that they had gotten quite a number of inquiries, that they don't see anything. You know, people looked in the antenna handbook, they don't see anything on its elevated speed method or the gap, which is not, like I say, not their invention. It was originally invented by a gentleman in England. Now, if you're looking at QST articles, you'll see they basically try to explain how this thing works. But the final part of you look at that article, they said they're not quite sure that they it seems like they were, you know, also grappling around with this may do this or that may do that. But that's why I brought this up, Dick, because I thought that here's one that we try to break down. Here's something, out of left field that we've never tackled in antennas. I think we hit upon almost every antenna conceivable. and there are a lot of them, but I don't know if this is really a dipole type configuration, because I can't figure out how those rods interact that way. Are they, and that the rods, are they interacting between each rod? In other words, if I took off a rod, will I just lose that band, or will detune the whole thing? In other words, what actually is taking place here, and the zigzag coax, how do you determine the zigzag? What frequency are you determining? You know, where is, what is it? Is it just a random zigzag? I mean, you know, questions like that I pondered on looking at this thing. So, like I say, if you get a chance, take a look at that QST article. Maybe we can pick it up next week or so and see what you think of the concept, over.
Okay. No promise, but I'll try. And got the reference. I'll have to find that particular issue of QST, because they're a little bit scattered. But see what we can do. We'll eventually figure this one out. And quite possibly it contains some concepts we can apply to other antennas. And the day may come when a variation of that will appear at the Ryan Visitors Center at Floyd Bennett Field. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah. As I say, someday maybe we can homebrew something similar for one band or two bands or whatever and see what happens. The interesting experiment, like I say, to try something different with this elevated feed. I've never actually tackled something that is an elevated feed other than, you know, vertical stuff in the air and maybe call them elevated feed to some extent. All right. Would you like to look at another one of these? I have one here. A little hard to explain. That's why I couldn't give an answer on the email. But it's an interesting question. Got some answers. Maybe you'd like to hear this one. Take over.
Fire away, sir.
Okay. I have a ham for rota. The gentlemen were discussing rotators for a couple of weeks. Yes, we were. Well, the problem is, it's up on top of a mast. And I find that every year for the last couple of years after the winter, I have to go up there and readjust the antenna. It flips around. I tightened the clamps, fuel clamps, one so tight on the mast that holds the antenna that I actually broke the clamp, had to get another one. Yet, same problem persists. It seems to creep off the set direction. The indicator is still correct. Everything seems to be correct, except for the beam that's slipping. What do you do in a case like this? Well, I can give you my answer, but I'll first turn it over to the net and see what everybody else does.
Okay. In my opinion, the major reason that a antenna slips is that it has a large moment of inertia, something with a very long boom that's heavy. A 20-foot, 25-foot, 30-foot boom can really do this easily. Second of all, almost all antennas that we can buy are gravity-balanced with the net wind-balanced. You really want the center of rotation to be also the center of wind pressure. Almost all Yagis have larger gaps between the directors up forward, and the driven element and reflector and first director out back have a much smaller gap, and you've got a feed line going back there. So there's a lot of weight in the back and nowhere near as much stuff in the front. Therefore, when you adjust the mounting clamp to the gravity point, it is rearward of the center of the boom. As such, when the wind blows, the antenna always wants to aim itself downwind. There's more boom in front than there is out back. And that continuous wind blowing, rocking it back and forth, eventually create slippage. If you put a weather vane, a vertical piece of aluminum, on a horizontally polarized Yagi, a vertical piece of aluminum, on the back of the antenna, behind the reflector, because it's cross-polarized to the signal coming out of the Yagi, it has no effect. But if you put a vertical piece of aluminum of the right area, you can make the antenna neutral. You probably notice that on a windy day, it'll turn clockwise a lot more easily than counterclockwise. because of this downwind weather vaning effect. When you get that weather vane just right, and you can calculate that, you know the diameter of the boom, you know how much extra boom you've got out in front, you can easily calculate how much wind load is on that out front. It's a product of area and distance from the pivot point. It's a kind of a moving average you have to do. And when you choose the right size of aluminum plate out back, you can make it wind neutral. The biggest antenna I ever built was an array of 16 Yagis on 432. It was 15 feet high, 15 and a half feet wide, 13 feet front to back, almost 5,000 cubic feet of antenna, all mounted at the 100-foot level of a tower. In the beginning, for the first few months, I rotated that great big antenna, 304 elements. I rotated it with an AR-22, a real chintzy little Cornell Dubilier rotator. Later on, I went over to a Ham M. I got away with that because there was one more pipe sticking out the back, which has a weather vane on it, and it made the antenna wind neutral. This is a very rarely discussed subject. I'm kind of amazed. And you'd be amazed how many guys with huge rotators on large antennas are grinding up the gears, either slipping the mast or grinding up the gears because of wind balancing. There are other techniques by which you can get greater binding force between the rotator and the mast and between the mast and the mounting clamp of the Yagi itself. But that's trying to put a Band-Aid on the problem. The original problem is the wind loading is not even front and back, and you can force it to be front and back. I've done it. Wonder what you did to solve the problem, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
It says K2KEY. Well, having a long boom beam up there years ago before I got your elegant way of taking care of this problem. Well, the boom, the beam I have up there, you strut, they balance. You balance the beam basically because of, like you say, the unbalanced situation. They use the struts that you adjust to keep the beam, you know, balanced. However, that creepage problem, I still experience some of it. And you can see on the map when I looked up, you can see where it was actually, you know, falling the map. So the easiest answer I found to it, I took the rotor down, put the rotor, it's a little bit of a problem, got to put it in the right support in a drill press, and I drilled right through the case of the rotor, right through the V of the rotor, coming out where the apex on the other side of the rotor is, and this is right in the center between the two U-clamps. I drilled also the plate that goes across on the front that the U-clamps pull back against the mast. I drilled that hole also. I put in there, goes right through, so when I put the beam back up, I went through all the whole thing, the mast, the whole thing, the plate, the mast, the rotor. I used a 3/8 bolt. It's not a regular bolt that you would go into the hardware store and purchase, you know, like one of these running threads that have a pan head on top. This bolt I got, it's a 3/8 bolt, and it's threaded only at the last approximately inch or so of the, in other words, you've got to get the right length bolt. Now, you've got to get a bolt also that's hardened, because if there's any movement there, it will shear a regular bolt. So I got a bolt that's known as, goes from 36 to 45 hardened. That's called Rockwell hardened. And you put that through. Now, you drill the hole. The holes were precisely drilled. I used a brooch or a reamer type device that is a number that is used so that when you put this bulb through, this whole thing, you actually have to tap it through gently. It's a tight, tight fit. But once everything now is tightened up, I've never had any movement. I have the same situation I did up at the beam on the plate that joins the beam to the vertical mast, and all. I pinned it the same way, Dick. Never had any problems with it drifting off after that, Dick, over.
Okay, you did something very smart. By using a bolt that doesn't have threads all the way, It's got a smooth section to it. That definitely helps on the so-called stress concentration point. The bolt going through tends to keep it from slipping. But if you were using thin-wall aluminum tubing,